time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
I'm Paul Daly, here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And tonight we're going to talk about the pilot episode of a new series on USA called Colony. This series has been created by Carlton Cuse of Lost fame. That's kind of our connection to the show. And co-executive producer Ryan Condal. Looks like his claim to fame is that he wrote the good Hercules movie 2 years ago. There were two Hercules movies.
Oh.
Yes, and he wrote the one that's recognized as the better of the two.
I'm delightfully out of touch with the Hercules movies, so good to know there's a good one and a bad one. I'll avoid the bad one.
The one with the rock is the good one.
Okay, as always.
Right. The stamp of approval.
So featured on this show, we have two favorites from shows that we've all loved before. So we have Josh Holloway from Lost playing the dad, Will. And we have
Sarah Wayne Callies, who I don't know if she was a favorite, but she was on Walking Dead. She was Laurie Grimes.
So we had a rough time not calling them Sawyer and Laurie for like a long time here. So if we slip up and accidentally say that, please just know why.
Yeah, most of my notes actually do say Sawyer does this, Sawyer does that.
Yeah, well, and especially confusing, all of a sudden then Paul would say, hey, did you see how Sarah did that? And I'm like, who's Sarah? And then he's like, that's Laurie's character's name. And I'm like, who's Laurie? No, her name's Katie. Way to be confusing. So this first little obstacle for the series is going to make us love these characters as the characters they are playing today and not have us continue to think of them as characters from their previous shows. That's their first hurdle, Paul.
It is a hurdle.
It is, because you know what? They didn't even like alter, I'm going to have to say, Josh's appearance one bit. I mean, his haircut is exactly the same, his scruffiness, his body type, his everything. Everything is exactly the same as when he played Sawyer. Now, a little bit different for Miss Sarah. When she played Laurie, we felt like she played kind of a pretty bedraggled kind of human. And, you know, she's the mom on the run with a small child.
In the zombie apocalypse.
With the zombies coming. So, you know, she looked a little haggard sometimes. But this one, she definitely looked softer, younger. They dressed her more, I said, kind of teenage at times. And then she just sort of like, they kind of did her hair a little bit softer. Her makeup was much softer. So I think she looked better to me than she did in The Walking Dead. So hooray for her.
Even some of the Sawyer mannerisms.
Yeah.
It must just be
Josh's mannerisms we're finding out.
It might be that when you are kind of a leading man guy like Josh Holloway or Matthew Fox or something like that, you just kind of are an actor, like a movie star kind of actor, you know, like they're hiring you, not necessarily someone to play that character so much as they want you to be that guy.
Well, so this will be tricky for them, really. Honestly, this will be a little tricky so that we don't just keep thinking, boy, Sawyer and Laurie have a crazy situation they're dealing with. We have to keep remembering they're Will and Katie.
They are Will and Katie Sullivan, and we start in their house. The show gets off to a really fast start, but we start very slow. In the morning, breakfast, Dad is making eggs, trying to persuade his son to have, I think it was one egg or something, so that the daughter could have two eggs, or I don't
remember. Yeah, who's
exactly
augmenting the egg situation with some cereal. So Dad is Josh Holloway, Will. He was definitely playing Mr. Mom, and that was a really funny role, actually, to see him playing, because again, going back to our Lost days, he was a total bachelor, no kids, no wife, no nothing.
Nothing to and tie so, him down.
Right. So to see him like being all like, honk, honk, I think your ride's here, like working on his little breakfast routine, super funny, very Mr. Mom-esque.
So he drops an egg off the counter, and this, on first viewing, seemed like, wow, he's really overacting how upset he is about this egg loss.
Yeah, he like really looked like someone punched him in the face when he dropped the egg.
Damn it!
Yeah.
That's a good story, Paul.
Yeah. That was really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So so Katie comes in on the scene, and Katie is wearing this blue top, blue bottomed outfit that I could only describe as like a middle school gym uniform. And to make it even a little more unusual for a 30-something-year-old mom to be sporting, the like neckline is cut out, and she used the neckline to tie up the sleeves in a jaunty tank top fashion. So again, we're playing like a funny young role with old Lori, Katie, Sarah here.
We find out at this point that the son's name is Bram, and Bram heads out to pick some oranges off the tree. And that gives us a shot of what it looks like outside the house.
I wrote down barbed wire was on the fence in the yard, but Paul was quick to point out to me that it's actually called razor wire. So you guys are going to want to keep track of this. It's razor wire.
Just before he heads outside, camera stays on not Lori, nope, but Katie, as she is looking at a picture of three kids.
Yeah, very
only two in the living room.
Wasn't that very like, I guess because we've been watching The Leftovers, that was very The Leftovers for, I guess everybody has pictures of their kids on their fridge. We do not. I feel like most people have fridges that don't actually accept magnets anymore. And so it's kind of funny to see people with a bunch of photographs. I also don't know a lot of people who print out photographs a whole bunch. Like they're either in frames or they're on your phone or they're on your computer. So it's still kind of funny for them to use that. I kind of think it's old fashioned. Do you? To kind of have like a snapshot of your family?
I don't know. We've
never had a snapshot of our family on the
fridge. Or, you know, good grades or anything. It's just
true,
sort
we
of
don't, I guess,
things that come
yeah,
and go. But
I don't know why.
But we kind of fell into this stainless situation, and now nothing sticks.
So. Nice, yes. Now, yeah, we're down that road. So Dad is kind of
going to work.
Yeah, and he's kind of staring at the kids, giving this funny, wistful look. And Katie says, you know, he's a good kid, which is funny because I didn't take that Will was looking directly at Bram. I thought he was just watching both the kids, which happened to be a boy and a girl.
Gracie.
Gracie is the younger kid. So it was weird that she said he's a good kid, but Will says they're all good kids. There was definitely some tension there, and it kind of gave me the idea that maybe that third kid on the fridge there might come into play here pretty quick. Before he heads off to work, they engage in a little smooch, and they have to do like a double take smooch where it seemed like a...
Oh yeah, he came back in for a little extra sugar.
He certainly did. And upon second viewing, Paul and I are going to call that more of a goodbye kiss and less of a just, hey, I'm into some extra sugar this morning kiss.
Will is actually Sully, Will Sullivan, and he works at the local mechanic's garage. This scene is meant to deliver a lot of exposition in sort of a walk-and-talky, you know, modern kind of way that is a little clumsy for my taste.
Well, it's hard to do walk-and-talks around a garage with tools and everything else. So I kind of took it like they were kind of giving us a little bit of like the mood of the community, if you will, because they kind of banter back and forth more broadly than I feel like guys in the shop might be.
Right.
So they weren't just talking like, whose car are we working on today? They were more talking like about families and just bigger picture kind of stuff.
What are you going to do after?
When this is all over,
when this
right?
is all over, yes.
So we're starting to get an idea. Obviously, we know something's going on here. And one of the guys said, you know, it's going to be all over by Christmas, which sort of, for Paul and I, indicated, okay, so then this has been going on for a while. We don't know, months, years, maybe. The coworker, Parker, is all sad. And they're asking him, like, what's up? What's going on with you? And he says that his brother was sent to the factory. Boy, that sounds like bad biz, Paul. Anytime someone is sent to the factory, you know what's sad about that? I kind of take it like that the human is ground up into food.
You never know.
Very Soylent Green-esque, right? If you're sent to the factory, I don't take it as you're going to go work at the factory. I take it as in like you're going to become...
Glue.
Yeah, glue.
Right.
Yeah, because who else is like sent to a factory?
Besides washed up racehorses.
Yeah. People are going to get ground up into food. That's what I'm saying.
One thing that I noticed about what they were doing in the garage, I don't work in a garage and I don't really know much about it, but they weren't working really on engines. They were putting things that I think are fuel cells into different trunks. Caroline and I watched a little bit of the behind the scenes stuff that USA had put out before the show came out. One thing that I remembered was that only certain people had cars. So I was wondering,
who would be needing all these car work, right?
Whose cars are they working on? Because they don't appear to be military vehicles.
No, they just look like regular old cars. Now, I have to say, this is when I'm very glad that I have Paul to watch TV with, because I would have looked around that mechanic's garage and noticed nothing about a fuel cell. I would never have thought, oh, hey, they're putting in fuel cells. Like, no. I'd have been like, huh, that guy looks sad about
his
brother.
They only had trunks open.
I don't even know what that means. I'm still like...
Well, that's not where the engine is normally.
Well, okay, fact. I know that much about cars. I would not go in my trunk to be like, something's wrong with the engine.
If you're in England, they call it the boot.
Oh, thanks, Paul.
That's our international moment of the podcast.
Nice. That was some layering, if you will. Mm-hmm. Nice. They were talking, too, about like the worst part of all this is that their families are separated.
Yes, that was the theme. That expositional delivery there was that there was... When this event happened, people were separated. And
that's kind of all we felt like we were supposed to really kind of suck out of that, right?
Yeah.
So Carlos, coworker, starts helping Will load up a van.
Because Will is going on a delivery. Carlos knows the details, and it's something that they've talked about before. Will offers for him to come with him, and Carlos is like, not me, man. I'm not that guy.
Which is kind of weird, because what does that mean? I'm not a delivery driver. I'm not that kind of guy. What? So now we're trying to figure out like, okay, so clearly this delivery is actually going to be a little more complicated. Turns out that he is not just delivering fuel cells to Santa Monica, but he is going to meet up with who I'm going to call a smuggler guy. His name is Spider.
I thought of him as a coyote.
Oh.
The people that run immigrants of the illegal variety back and forth between Mexico and the United States. But his name is Spider.
Isn't that enchanting? Like right. When a guy named Spider is like, hello, I'm here for you. I'm Spider. I'm like, oh, no.
Why don't
I totally
you,
took a wrong turn. Crap.
Why don't you climb into this deep freeze with me and we'll cuddle?
So he asks him to trade out IDs, the Santa Monica ID for the LA one. Turns out that Will has an ID kind of band on his arm. We found these fascinating because one of our kids is deafblind, and we had been at a deafblind conference. And what was super cool about the way that they handled the name tags was that, of course, the name tags are brailled, so you don't want to be touching someone's chest to read braille. So they had them just the same as these armband name tags.
So we had seen it before.
But we kind of thought that they were very innovative and futuristic.
But
and
that
so,
was the only place we'd ever seen
that's
it.
The only place we've ever seen them. So I thought it was super cool that they were sort of taking that extra step. Like, well, they wouldn't have regular name tags. They would have this like next step, more innovative name tags.
He does get stopped at a roadblock before he even gets to Spider. So this gave us a question mark, though, about kind of the... When he pulled up to where he got out of the van, there was a gigantic wall, and there were some special effects shots where you could see some buildings had been kind of beaten up around town. We already kind of knew that there were these walls, right?
Yeah, some sort of walls were going to be around, either keeping something in, out, we don't know what's exactly the deal yet.
So is Santa Monica just another walled-off cell?
So Spider gives him a parka and says, you're going to want to put this on. And they climb into a deep freezer that I've only seen something like this in my grandparents' basement. And they put like a tarp over them, and Spider crawls in right in with him, with Will, and snuggles up. And they put a tarp over the two of them and start pouring some ice on them. Not that much ice, though, Paul, really, right? Like
not
one
enough
bucket
to make
full?
A difference, no.
I wouldn't have thought so. If we were having a party and you came home with that much ice for that size cooler, I'd have been like, where's the ice? Like, what'd you just do there? It seemed like it wouldn't have made that big of a difference. Spider immediately... The gracious host starts asking inquisitive little nuggets and says, you know, where are you going? Why are you doing this? What's the scene?
Will spills it immediately. He's going to search for his son who would be 12 years old now that was separated on the day that the walls basically came down.
Yeah, it says on the arrival. So again, the fact that he said that he would be 12 now, that was another indicator that this didn't happen last month or something like this. This has been going on for a while. They drive up to the Santa Monica boundary, and there's a huge, thick wall. Immediately, Paul and I were starting to think about the Berlin Wall and Bridge of Spies we just saw, and the whole idea of like having to make it through the security checkpoint and having this sort of constant harassment on both sides. But what it made us realize was this idea that like, well, wait a minute, maybe it's not that just this city is walled off. Maybe it's actually that every city is walled off. So we were thinking that maybe, I sort of started drawing on my paper, that it was sort of more like a honeycomb kind of look, where like every pod was a different city. And so that makes this all a little more interesting. So it's not just that LA is being picked upon. It's just that LA is the one cell that we're going to kind of get into, but that multiple cities or every city is going to be handled in this clumping cell kind of way.
And they don't want mixing because...
Not at all.
Part of what happens is the LA drivers have to get out and go and wait in a little waiting area, and then Santa Monica drivers come out of their little penalty box and then go into the truck because now they're going to continue with the delivery in Santa Monica.
So super intrigued.
A giant scanner starts passing over the trailer.
And Spider's so fancy. He has like some hot technology inside that deep freezer. He has like a flat screen TV in there with some like monitoring equipment.
So they can see what's going on.
Yeah. So they actually see that everything's, you know, seemingly to go well. They weren't detected thermally or x-rays or anything like that.
Yeah, everything goes fine. The truck pulls ahead for a little bit and then... Boom! Gigantic explosion knocks out all of the equipment, all of the people in the area, and the only survivor is our hero, Will, climbs out of the deep freeze over Spider's shattered body.
Oh, Lord.
Climbs on top of the rig that's on its side and is immediately surrounded not only by human guards, but these flying... Batteries not included style drones that come out of a hole in the roof of the section of the wall that's cut out where the checkpoint was.
So this part was done with a lot of computer animation, and to me, it looked just like a video game. Honestly, I think they actually used the little character that's Daryl Dixon to stand on top of the rig, because I swear I've seen that same exact look like in between the Walking Dead like shows when they're like, "Aren't you want to come and fight with me?" Like that business. And it's totally like his video gamed character. So
you're saying it was less than convincing in
that shot? I have kind of some question marks about the pilot in general. About,
was it all done at once?
Or just the production value and the editing and the...
Did they do it on the cheap, maybe?
I don't know. I'm not sure. We're very much looking forward to episode 2 so that we can see if some of this gets sort of ironed out once it was greenlit. But some of the scenes, like that scene, stuck out so badly. There's other scenes that we're going to point out, but it was like they had this edit and then someone was like, no, take that out and just plunk this in. But it sounds like boom, like when you're watching it and it's all like melodic and everything, and then all of a sudden it's like boom, like it's just wrong note. It sticks out like sore thumb. And so you're looking at the screen like, wait, what? That seemed totally fine. And then this seems very fake and strange. I don't even know why they had to do that. They could have done close-up shots. They didn't need to do him standing on the top of the rig and everything.
Well, if it had been done well, a camera pullout is the right way to kind of convey a sense of he's in deep shit mood.
I vote you could have done it from behind his back, though, and shot the guys from the other direction, from like his vantage point, and saw all the guys and all the drones coming at you. You didn't have to do like the full screenshot. You could have just done it with real actors. It wouldn't have looked so weird.
And then he would have gone, son of a bitch.
Exactly. So meanwhile, we have Katie, and she is out doing a little bike ride. Her outfit was super wonky. She was wearing what I can only say is like a European World War II strange little pantaloons with like these little lace-up.
I think it was a regular skirt, but yeah.
No, dude, they were like sort of pantaloony. I don't know. They were weird. You have never seen a woman wear this.
Well, we know from behind-the-scenes stuff, two things. A, no one has cars, so bike riding is just a fact of life now. And two, Did I say A or B?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so...
A and two.
Right, two. The creators, Carlton and Ryan, were inspired by imagery that they had seen and kind of shared collectively of the Nazi occupation of France.
And now why I'm saying that simple things like her wardrobe are indicative of that they had some ideas and were driven by one idea, and then it seems like scenes or afterthoughts were plunked in. What I was describing to you guys earlier of what she was wearing was what I would describe like an Abercrombie and Fitch girl to be sporting around after cheerleading practice. And then here she's dressed like a grandma going to deliver her tulips at the Dutch market. Like, it so doesn't fit that it seems like, okay, you must have filmed that part where you were acting almost as if you had like a period piece inspired moment here. And then you kind of forgot all about that 6 months later when you were filming these kitchen scenes and you were having them come in. And she seems like a completely different mom, because I'm telling you that this woman would not have these two outfits. The woman who is wearing this outfit riding her bike would wear like a white, see-through-y kind of flowy nightgown. You get what I mean? And like the girl who's wearing these Abercrombie PJs would have been wearing like exercise pants and like a hoodie and like a very normal modern outfit. So these two things don't make sense. And that's where I just wonder if they had filmed the pilot two different times and had to plunk scenes in differently when they're doing
editing. What she's doing on her bike right now does seem to evoke that French.
Yes. Yes. Very European.
Piece, because I don't remember if it was The Longest Day or another old war movie depicting Normandy, but they show some of the French resistance, and the French resistance had a lot of women in it. And what did they wear but skirts? And they rode bikes. It looked exactly like this.
So it totally makes sense. What I'm saying is, like, I feel that, and you could feel that sense like right away to me when I saw her. There's like the crossover body purse. There's like just very, if she was a modern day girl and you were not using that, she'd be wearing a backpack. She would not be wearing like crossbody satchels and stuff. There's just very specific choices that are interesting, and I'm hoping that they kind of pick a avenue and stick with it, because otherwise it's going to keep feeling very choppy if they have these like moments of, it's like seeing a painting in the middle of it, you know, where you're like, well, that moment came out of a completely different time and space.
She sees a couple of things on her bike ride. She sees a wall made up of pictures. It's not exactly clear, but these are probably people that are cut off from people inside the wall. They may be dead, but I was going with just missing to them in some way.
Yeah, I put dead question mark, separated question mark. The strange thing was how there was like a man walking along with a cardboard box, and he was not indiscriminately taking down photos. He just seemed to go and take down like one photo and put it in the box. I don't know exactly what that's about. Maybe that person turned factory. I don't know.
So he was allowed to do that.
Yeah, and no one bugged him.
And Katie stops for a second, and some Gestapo-looking goon in a red hat and a mask says, move along, move along.
Oh, and she does like super fast. Absolutely. So she starts riding her bike again. And then we have our completely French cafe scene moment, like absolutely perfect shot by shot, second by second moment of what it would be like during World War II. So we have these people, they're eating outside at a cafe, and Katie watches this red hat crew come screeching up. They jump out, they grab a guy who's just like eating lunch at the cafe. He's like screaming, I didn't do anything. Nobody does anything at all. Nobody tries to grab him or say, no one else tries to say,
you don't want to get involved.
But no one else tries to say, what are you doing? Or what happened? Or John, I'll call your mom. Or, I mean, like nothing. All that happens is they take him away and everyone goes back to eating their meal. And this goes back to what the footage had told us.
I think it was Carlton.
Yeah, specifically.
Painted this pictures. Yeah, it's pretty specifically about pictures of Frenchmen and women sitting, drinking their coffees at cafes and Nazis marching by in Paris.
And really, so this whole concept, I started talking to Paul about the whole idea of like, keep calm and carry on. And that whole brainwashing notion of, you know, if it's not happening to you right at this very second, your very best bet is just to keep your head down and keep doing what you're doing. As insane as it was for those people to just like continue to eat their bagel while the guy is like gripping onto the table and getting pulled away. That's what they did. And apparently during World War II, that was not uncommon. So super creepy, but an interesting glimpse into that time.
I noticed another just tiny nugget in this scene, which was just stuck out to me as odd, is the vehicle that they stopped and picked the man up in was a Cadillac Escalade, all made up to be like a police vehicle. It just kind of sat funny for a second because police don't drive Cadillacs. They drive the, you know, the stripped down Chevys that are made up to be cop cars or whatever, but they're not Cadillacs.
Right. So what's up with that?
I think it's just a tiny indicator of how things go with those that cooperate with whoever's running the show now. The police get to have Cadillacs now.
Okay, so they have fancier stuff, huh?
Yeah, so Katie pulls up to a house, and she has her dog with her, and the dog has to wait outside the fence.
So when she goes inside the home, it looked a lot like kind of, I was saying, sort of like a home health nursing home kind of, I don't know, something like that. That's what it made me feel like. It made me feel like some sort of makeshift
communal kind of
clinic-y
thing.
Kind of something.
Oh, you thought a clinic? Okay.
Well, yes, yeah, something like that. Like, I can't quite describe it.
I was thinking more communal living. Like, these people are not related, but they all have to live here, or at least a bunch of them have to.
Yeah,
live here.
Or at least I was taking it to, like, maybe they had to come there during the day. Like, I don't know, almost some sort of adult daycare-y kind of drop off. Because everybody seems sick or infirmed or in wheelchair or something. Something was up with them. So I don't know.
Why Katie is there.
Yeah, no, it totally does. So she is looking for Heloise. And Heloise, again, takes this moment, pilot style, to give us the parameters to which this show is going to deal with medicine and the medical needs of the citizens.
Right.
So Heloise tells us point blank, she says, certain conditions aren't being given any medicines. Diabetes is one of them. No insulin is available and no one is making it. Except me, Heloise. So like she just like lays it all out for us. So again, you know what? This I thought was also
read the pamphlet at the door.
It was exactly like, did you get the newsletter? Heloise is making insulin. Again, this was kind of World War II-ish, right? When there was sort of this thought of like weeding out the sicklings and making the bloodlines more pure and strong and everything. And so this concept of like, if you were kind of like constantly sickly, no one was putting any energy into making sure that you had ongoing medical supplies and all that kind of stuff. Like you were just, it was better off if you just passed away because we don't really want your genetics into the mix anymore.
Well, I had read up on occupied France a little bit between.
What?
Yeah, between when we started and now. And one of the things that goes along with being occupied is just a constant shortage of supplies because everything that you used to make as a country, not everything, just kind of like 80-20 split, is being sent to whoever's occupied you.
So it's totally being diverted to your captors.
Yes.
So so she takes Katie out to kind of this kind of back house kind of space where there's tons of dog kennels. And she says that they have figured out how to make insulin from the pancreas of dogs. Now, me and Paul had a real quick flashback to her tying her dog out front. And we were both like, wait a minute. A, is she dropping her dog off as some sort of weird trade? Or B, is her pooch magooch going to get some home pancreas care? Because this looks pretty crazy. So Katie pulls out a bottle of wine for her trade with old Heloise.
They swap for a moment, but as Katie inspects the little vial, she finds it to be warm, which insulin needs to be stored cold, and she says it's cloudy, which I assume means it's supposed to be clear.
I would assume.
No deal. Give me back my wine. Heloise is not into this Indian giving business.
No, she is not. A deal is a deal when you deal with Heloise, my friend.
However, she did not know that this was going to be a gunfight.
Right. Heloise brought insulin to insulin, a gunfight.
Right.
And so Katie simply pulls out a big old handgun.
And she cocks it, and it looks like she doesn't want to kill anybody, but she will
I'm pretty sure
she would. Shoot a bitch here.
She would shoot a Heloise, that's for damn sure. In the course of her making her way out the front door, we get the information that the fact that she has a gun, other people kind of yell out, like, you're crazy. You know, if the drones catch you, they're going to kill us all. And everyone's, like, shocked that she has a gun and all this. So now we're kind of given that little inkling of information, like, oh, okay, so the drones that we saw over at Will's explosion also are monitoring everyone. And I guess no one's allowed to have weapons. So super good to know. Now we're going to head over to Bram.
Bram and his friends are hanging out on the bleachers of, it looks like the same high school as Fear the Walking Dead to me.
Hey, no doubt. I was just going to ask you that. I was going to ask you, like, how many times did you ever, like, hang out on the bleachers like that?
At Kingwood High School, if you'd wandered off to the bleachers at lunch, they would have called your parents.
I don't know. You would. There definitely would have been discipline. There's no hanging out on the bleachers, so I don't know. But this is where they have a makeshift farmer's market, where we're going to do some trading.
We find out that Bram uses the family oranges to barter for better snack packs and things during
or at
lunch.
At least variety, right? Yes. Variety. So one girl's mom has made some tortillas, and some other boy has some other stuff. And so they start passing it all around and everything. And you know what it also made me realize? It made me realize how valuable those oranges were. And so that made me think back to that razor wire and made me wonder, maybe that razor wire is more about keeping people out of their yard for oranges. At first, I kind of thought maybe it was a little keeping people in. Like, I don't know why. But I guess now I'm thinking, no, it was keeping people out because they had
those, like, oranges were like softballs. They were huge.
Yeah, no, they looked great. Yeah. Nice oranges, Bram.
So Jackson starts making noise.
Bullerson. I totally hated this line. Again, OMG with being out of place. Ready for the wank note, like, boom, into the scene.
He says, this market, nothing happens at this market without me, and I need to get my beak wet.
Gross. Which, and weird. This was a young teenager. This is not a line a young teenager would say. So I turn to Paul and say, that came out of nowhere. Why the heck would this young kid say, get my beak wet?
And I explain that in Godfather 2, when they explain Don Vito's background, when he moves into New York, he finds that there's already someone there kind of managing illegal businesses. And when he finds out that Don Vito plans on performing some illegal business of his own, he informs him, you can do that as long as I get my beak wet, which means take my cut.
Totally got what it meant, and good to know that it came from The Godfather. But how much did it sound like the strum of the guitar was like, ding, 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 wah. Right. Why did that kid just say that? That sounded so out of place.
He looked more of like a... Like
he
a,
seemed like a dope. Like he would just.
If this was Spider-Man, Bram would have been Peter Parker, yes. And this guy would have been Flash Thompson, the guy that beats up Peter Parker on a pretty regular
right.
basis.
So, do you see Thompson saying crap like "wet
no,
my beak"?
He would mostly.
He'd have been like,
say,
bah, bah, bah.
Parker.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was looking for. So again, a little weird note. Maybe we're just getting our footing here for what the characters' voices sound like. But we got to figure out, are we modern teenagers? Are we modern people? Are we going to dress and talk like modern people? Or are we going to wear European clothes and talk like we're in The Godfather? Well, what's our freaking scene
remember
here?
Remember International Assassin, how they stole in The Leftovers. They stole a little bit of The Godfather there and they just acknowledged it. And I theorized that they just like The Godfather, and rather than, you know, fake it, they just embraced it and said, that's right. We did take it from The Godfather.
But you know what? Here's what I'm saying. If Spider had said to one of his guys, hey, get out of here. You're not doing any deals. If you're doing a deal, I have to get my beak wet too. I would have kind of let that fly. But this dopey-ass 13-year-old who was just, like, too big for his backpack, kind of, sorry, he's never seen The All Godfather, right. And he's just not that savvy. And so, like, I just don't go for it, you know?
I can go with that.
He was a little more, like, slap the oranges out of your hand.
Right. In the rest
know?
Of the
like,
episode...
just pick your characters, though. Who's going to be cool?
There were probably plenty of people in this episode who could have said that line.
Hell yeah. Any of the mechanics guys. Any of the mechanics guys could have said it. So, anyway, we're going to keep kind of... trying to puzzle our way through to, like, whose voice is going to come through as strong in this? Who is the showrunner? Is it the guy who loves Godfather? Is it the guy who loves this European sense? Whose voice is going to kind of, like, come out here?
So as Bram makes his way over to Jackson, he swings his backpack at his face, kind of, I don't know if he breaks his nose, but he does bloody it and says, there, your beak's wet. And then the authorities show up and they all scatter to the wind.
I thought they were authorities. I kind of thought they were just like the principal and the goon squad, right? The usual, like the gym teacher, you kids, yeah. That kind of crap, you know?
Well, that's enough of the authorities.
Yeah. Adult figures, right?
Yep.
One of them should have yelled, get your beak wet. That would have made more sense.
So we cut to a completely stock scene of, this is definitely Sawyer locked up.
Oh my gosh, right? He absolutely, Josh Holloway, like, pulled his Sawyer voice out to do this entire part.
And we don't find out much, except for there are a lot of people locked up in this place that is just kind of cordoned off with chain link fence. It's not even like a real jail.
Well, it's just like a room, kind of, like, that has, like, chain link kind of cages around it. I don't know.
It does speak to the idea of doing it on the cheap.
Yeah, or like very makeshift, right?
Yeah.
So they're all men that are in here, and they all kind of seem to be sort of around that same age. I mean, if I would have looked at that group, I'd have said between the age of 25 and 50, right?
Kind of a fighting man's age.
Yeah, I would say those who could do the most damage to somebody else. They were all locked up, and here's Will, you know, screaming Sawyer-esque lines.
Well, the point is, he wants a phone call. He thinks he deserves a phone call. He is not getting his phone call. And they kind of beat him with a rifle through the chain link fence.
Well, he does that Sawyer move where he sticks his face through just to be a little extra nudgy. And, yeah. You know what? If any single person who I had locked up stuck their face at me and said something snotty, I could not keep my hand from not slapping at whatever was sticking out of the bars, right? If it's your nose, if it's your hands, if it's your head, whatever you're doing, get your face back inside the enclosure, right? Hands inside the vehicle. Will. So here's the other part about that. The camera totally lingered on this guy who's a very Tobey Maguire lookalike. Paul thought he totally looked like the kid from American Beauty, the dude with the paper sack blown around in the wind. The only reason why I care is because we sort of lingered on him and he actually got like a line where he's like, they're not going to give you a phone call, that kind of thing. This is my little prediction for future shows. I feel like this guy's going to show up again. So when we see him with this full beard and this dark hair, this Tobey Maguire dude, we'll know it when we see him. I think he's going to end up coming, maybe some sort of inside spy dude. I don't know.
So back at the Sullivan house, everyone has expected Will home a long time ago. He's not there. Sister Madison shows up with son Hudson. Hudson is the one that needs the insulin.
So Madison is Katie's sister, and so this is aunt to the kids. Hudson's her nephew.
It's unclear if they live there, if they're coming over for dinner.
This is a little sketchy. And I think, honest to God, if you looked at the beginning of the pilot to like whenever they ran the pilot, I bet it changed. Like I bet at first Madison and Hudson live next door. And by the end, they live in the bedroom, like in the third story or something.
This was
like
very...
there's something a little bit off about this. Why it matters is because it turns out that they have a curfew. So the fact that Madison comes over, or I shouldn't even say that, Madison enters through what appears to be like a backdoor mudroom kind of thing. What we're trying to figure out is like, does she live there with them? Because otherwise, how is she out after curfew? And we kind of come to see that curfew is a really big deal. So Katie says, look, Will hasn't come home. I'm going to go out and look for him. And of course, everyone's freaked out because they're like, no way, it's too close to curfew. We get the idea that like you're going to be shot on sight, basically. So she says, too bad, like she's just going to go. She heads off over to Carlos, who has a slamming RV, and he just peeps his little head out and gives her the like, hey, honey, what's going on? Like, why are you out here after curfew, you little Muppet? What you doing, boo-boo?
Right before curfew.
Yeah, bad news. And so she is like trying to get some info out of Carlos, and Carlos is not giving any.
He's all bros before hoes here.
He very much is.
He does not give up any information.
Not even a little, and doesn't even do that very typical TV show move where he's like, maybe you should go home and he's taking care of things. Like doesn't wink an eye at her in any form or fashion. It's just like, he came to work today, went out on delivery, skedat. The drones are coming, and like closes the door on her face.
Yeah, she leaves without any answer. She pedals her way out of there, and we hear the sirens start to go off, which from the context clues, we can assume means
curfew. Should be in your bed.
Yes.
You should not be on the streets, my friends. So right away, the drones come whipping around the corner and, of course, are coming like directly at where Katie is riding her bicicleta.
She notices an all-terrain personnel vehicle or troop carrier behind her. And what does she do? She ditches the bike in the middle of the road completely inconspicuously and hides underneath the troop carrier.
So I had a complete flashback to so many Walking Dead moments with this military vehicle. I totally wrote down in my thing that it was a tank. I don't know anything. Paul's like, it doesn't have treads. And I'm like, what? I don't even, yeah. Like, this should be more accessible to those who don't care about that crap. So she's laying underneath this thing. And so we get the idea that I guess the amount of armor that the vehicle would have had on it was blocking the drone's ability to detect Katie laying on the ground. So while she's laying under there, though, we've seen this moment happen definitely in Walking Dead and maybe I'm sure other shows where the police are grabbing a guy or whatever we're calling them, grabbing a guy out of kind of looks like a bar or a nightclub or something like that. As they do, he's, you know, resisting and they push him down to the ground. And so when his eyes come up, they, of course, meet directly to Katie's, who is under the
troop carrier
thing, whatever. Vehicle. Definitely that moment was like deja vu for me because I could just remember Rick Grimes doing that, having that same exact moment in the bedroom with those bad guys under the bed kind of thing, all those kind of moments. So it definitely like kind of raised my heart rate in a way that was purely based on my memories and experiences of other shows because I wasn't actually scared for Katie or anything at this moment because I didn't care anything about Katie at this moment. But I was actually getting a little like nervous just because I was thinking of like Rick Grimes under the bed and all these zombies coming to get you. So it was kind of a funny little like tapped into my other experiences.
I think it was meant to. But all is well here because the drone kind of monitoring this police action leaves in front of the troop carrier as it pulls out in a shot that's shot from above. So we see that it leaves Katie just completely exposed. Now, I was kind of wondering, like, what has changed about this moment from a few minutes ago when you were needing to hide from drones that now makes it so that, okay, now you can just keep riding your bike home. That's apparently uninteresting because she does arrive back at home.
Well, and one thing I'm going to point out again about this like production kind of confusing continuity kind of stuff, that's it's going to be small, I admit, but at the same time, it's going to keep being like disruptive. So she's laying underneath a car, okay? And the car is going to drive off from her. Now, Paul, how do you think your body might lie if you felt like the wheels were going to be going by you?
I would be as flat as possible.
And like a stick, right? Like a pencil? Like your arms are down at your side, your legs are straight, right?
They'd be a little turned so that my toes could lay down, but yeah.
Wow, that's like super elaborate. Okay, but you're definitely, most definitely legs together, right?
Yeah, mostly.
Okay, so here's the weird thing. So the thing goes away from her, and then we get this cutaway to like an overhead shot. She is completely laying to the side. Like imagine someone running, but laying down. Like her legs are spread out, and it's all funny and everything. What the what? What? It seems like all these shots were like plunked in from a previous shooting day, and they just were like, I don't know, we need to have a little extra shot here. Just put that in. And even though someone would have said like, but what the hell? Why would she possibly be? She would never have laid like that under it. That's not how you hide. That's weird. Those small things are just super distracting to me.
Distracting or not, she makes it home.
She does.
But no Will. And everyone's like, oh my God, but whatever. So next day starts. And because she can't stay outside anymore, she's had her limit of post-curfew exploration. And she heads to a house where she finds a man working on the roof of a house.
We do get a wide city shot as we're sort of opening the day. And you can see that the walls are actually behind the Hollywood sign, like up on the mountain.
The two of them talk, and it's clear that they know each other very well, and they're very friendly. And she confides in him that Will has not come home yet. And she's pretty torn up about it. She takes a few moments to respond. He is a little cryptic, but he mentions basically that he and Will have a shared past or history that could have possibly landed them on the kind of lists that the government used to clear out the previously existing police, military, whatever.
Okay. And so one thing too that I noted is that I didn't feel like this guy was Will's friend or anything. Like, it's not like she went and said, you know, oh gosh, Barney, Fred's missing. Like, it's not like that. They're not pals. She's not run off to Will's best friend to like let them know. But definitely that this guy would have some ability to call and would have some way to know what Will's background was and everything in order to be of assistance. She's going to go head to the hospital and just be certain that something didn't happen and he wasn't just taken in.
And he offered to make some calls.
So Katie shows up at the hospital and it is frantic. There are a lot of things going on. And
a lot of bleeding people.
Yeah. And so it turns out that on the TV, it says that there was an explosion at Santa Monica. And so everybody's like...
Which we know
like,
was yesterday. And these people are like actively bleeding now. But whatever.
Yeah. But maybe there's more. I don't know. Maybe there's more than one. Maybe this happens all the time. So this one guy comes out and he's like super pissy. He's super interested in talking to Katie, but for no good reason, because Katie is like saying to him, what happened? And you would think he was like busy and he'd be like buzzing through, but he's not. He's like real insistent to be like, what's going on is we don't have any beds. And these like resistance jerks are just blowing things up. And he's like coming at her in this weird way that I thought like, whoa, dude, like move about your business. Ignore her.
Again, more kind of exposition stuff just delivered in this kind of clumsy sort of broadcasting.
Yeah.
We want you to know that not everybody appreciates the resistance.
Yeah. And that was like basically the whole thing. Like he was like coming into her face to like say this whole thing. So Katie is walking around trying
she
to ask.
Pushes
you know,
her way to the nurse's station and asks if they have Will Sullivan on the roll. But the woman she runs into, who I will not assume is a nurse, gets called away to something else. I think maybe even to deal with that guy.
Mr. Yelly. So she, Katie, goes in and takes this opportunity to take a couple steps back into the medicine area and quickly finds a refrigerator that has a big bin of insulin, which, like a pro, she just pours into her satchel and takes it all and turns around. And the nurse is like coming back right as she's kind of exiting that medicine area. And the nurse is all like, what are you doing? And I did like this bit of acting. Katie was all like, I can't find my husband. Like as if she was just wandering and she meandered into a medicine room, just being like, Will, are you in the medicine room? And just like completely wandered back out. So I thought she played that pretty darn well.
Surprise, surprise, they cannot find Will Sullivan on their roll, and Katie's like, okay, well, I guess I'll go check someplace else, see you, bye.
But awkwardly, the nurse adds a little line, is like, and if I see you back here, I am going to tell Homeland about you.
So like, I think we can assume what? Homeland is maybe Homeland Security, something like that. So Homeland is going to be that policing
force. Or something. It's somebody. I don't even know. But I thought it was funny. Like, I'm sorry, you're calling Homeland because what? Because I dared to ask if my husband was a patient.
Outside, Katie approaches a payphone and uses a credit card to make it go. Because, I don't know, maybe cell phones don't go in this post.
Good call. There's definitely, we didn't see any cell phone action. So they have this awesome party covert talk where she's all like, hi, did my friend come to the party?
This was kind of interesting because to know how to speak in this code, you would need to have arranged it ahead of time.
And she was very good at it. And so was the other person. Like, they were very like, no, actually, I think he got a ride home with someone else. And he's like, oh. And he's like, but I think whenever he's done with the other people, he's going to be coming right back home. And it was like, wow, this is really tricky business. So I liked it. But again, this does kind of either make me think that like everybody in the whole land is in on this sort of, I don't know, all this covert operations, which I guess the Heloise world and the this whole, I guess it shows us there's a lot of people that are kind of in on this kind of business. Or I don't know if there's more going on with old Katie here.
Back in the lockup with Will, he didn't get there in time to snag a bunk or even a pillow or anything. So he's just kind of on the ground. And the guy he's talking to must be an old timer because he himself has a cot.
And he is like the bottom bunk, man.
And they are chatting about this and that. Will asks him something along the lines of, have you or anyone or something like that, have you ever seen them? And the guy replies, no one ever sees them.
So, okay.
Everyone's called to attention. when a goon squad appears and starts yelling for a Will Bowman.
So everyone like stands up and gets in line, right? And he's yelling.
Well, they're in a very prone, like on their knees with their fingers.
Hands, right, laced behind their hands.
Yeah.
Right, laced behind their head. And they're yelling for Will Bowman. And they get Will Sullivan to stand up. And he's like, my name is Will Sullivan. And he totally gets a smack. And they're like, not anymore.
When we come back to him, he's with the goon squad that just kneecapped him. And they tell him that they're taking him to the Jeezy.
The Jeezy, which is totally Kanye Yeezy hilarious. The
Jeezy.
The Jeezy Louise. So they apparently, Paul knew that green is sci-fi code for the privileged area.
I've seen it in other shows.
So what's the show that's like, you feel like there's a lot of the stuff that's like similar? Battle what?
Battlestar?
Oh, well, Battleship? Battle what? Galactica?
Battlestar Galactica had a section of the show where the good guys had colonized a planet, but the Cylons show up and become an occupying force. There was no green zone for those people. It was what sprang to mind first was George Romero's Land of the Dead, where he had worked out a caste system, and the privileged lived in what they called the green. That was it.
Intrigue. So, Paul's right. They're totally heading to Privilege Land. So they head up to this huge security gates, like big armored gates with guards and everything.
Right. This is not just like a gated community, you know, Weasel Gate. This is
not Weasel Gate.
This is a big, heavy gate. And they are in a troop carrier with a couple of those Escalades as escort. So this is a pretty serious deal that he's involved in.
So they show us the inside of a cocktail party, and you can see the goon squad's going to walk old Will through this mess with his dirty, nasty, have been in an explosion ensemble and his nasty self. They have like a jacket over his handcuffs. And
he's kind of looking around, kind of amazed. I think he's meant to be looking at the luxury, basically, that they're having to cry about a single egg being lost. And these people are having a soiree after curfew with, you know, stuff of all
lots
kinds.
Lots of food and stuff like that. Absolutely. Now, the thing that like caught me about this was that no one at the cocktail party cared at all that the goon squad was walking through with a shackled prisoner type. That part was so strange. Like, Paul and I, we've seen a million movies where some ne'er-do-well bursts in on a high society scene, and every single time you get the clutching of the pearls, like, I never, and someone like being like, oh, and you know, someone dropping the punch bowl or something. Like, there's always some sort of reaction from the high society crowd that's all very like, oh. And nobody even gives a crap that this is happening at all.
This will date us, but when Caroline mentioned that to me the first time we talked about it, I said, you mean like the Karate Kid in the country club? She's like, exactly. But
totally. But you can think of a million different examples of any time when somebody looks all disheveled and comes into the wrong scene.
Rodney Dangerfield in the country club or the caddies in the pool.
Every single time, everyone stops, everyone stares. Nobody stopped, nobody stared.
They take Will up to an office where a Weasley-looking individual pops his head in and immediately starts trying to talk to Will.
What I noticed about this room was that there was a lot of art leaning against the wall, and it all seemed like art that we should recognize, even though I didn't see like a specific piece represented there, but I felt like it was all supposed to be reminiscent to me of like how the Nazis like took all of the priceless art and just kind of hoarded it away.
The fact that it wasn't hung up seemed to speak more to a desire to keep it from you, rather than
no one was going to enjoy it,
than display it.
Right. It's so strange. And the other people around, besides Proxy Weasley here who gets involved, all have this very like Xanax in the water kind of attitude about everything.
Except for the man who is revealed as Proxy Alan Snyder. Everyone else is too mellow.
Very mellow. Very mellow.
He starts working on him and he says, basically, we know who you are. and we know you've been hiding. We know your background, your military, your law enforcement background. Turns out Will has been an Army Ranger and has been working for the FBI, and he went into hiding when everything happened, whatever that was, whenever the change happened.
And he does get real backslappy with Will and, you know, tells Captain LaGarza to get these handcuffs off, like that kind of thing. Like, oh, come on now. Like, we're just pals. You like, what would you like to drink? Blah, blah, blah. Being real, real palsy and schmoozy.
Will is quick to say that he is not a member of the resistance. And Snyder implies that if they had any indication that he was, he'd already be dead. So
so move on, Will.
Yeah.
So they tell him they have a mission for him, basically, that he is to root out the resistance because they are causing too much trouble. And
someone named Geronimo is their leader.
Yeah, which totally we picked up on super quick that Geronimo was the last Native American holdout.
Last Apache war chief.
Specific.
Yes.
Apache war chief. This chick comes up behind them and is totally dead behind the eyes and is all like, it's time. Like, just really gross. Everything about her was like icky, gross. Her hair, makeup, clothing, everything was weird. When I say weird, I don't mean like outlandish. I just mean like not what you would see people wear or do their hair. So Paula like immediately was like, you know what? This is starting to remind me a little Hunger Games-y. They weren't so outlandish as that. Like, it wasn't meant to be that crazy. But there was a sense of that for sure.
Right. When they finally get to District 1 and they're going to the fancy parties, I think in the second movie.
But almost like runway fashion, like not things people would normally wear, but
yeah.
Just like outlandish. So all the people get in front of this large picture window and they all start watching outside. My first thought was that it seemed like they were having like a rolling blackout kind of thing, in that you could sort of sense that like energy was kind of flowing. It seems strange. I can't really explain it. I thought it was a rolling blackout. But then when you're like watching it, it was like it was all kind of getting gathered. And then all of a sudden, whatever was getting sucked up to the sky.
I don't think that that was like a launch or anything physical that would have, you know, left the atmosphere like that. I thought it was a transmission of not communication, but energy of some kind. Like whatever it is that the invading force is here to do, that's how they're sending it to, you know, whoever's collecting
it.
Yeah.
So then, do you think then this is like an alien situation now?
Well, I was kind of hoping that it wasn't, but
is it starting to feel like it's got to be an alien?
It is feeling very much like an alien invasion, yes.
So interesting, because at this point, we had no idea if what we were up against. So Will tries to act cool, and he's all, oh, yeah, I've seen this, you know, from my house, too.
And Snyder isn't buying it. Will is not, he brings up the word collaborate. He says, you want me to collaborate, which is a word that just goes along. It goes hand in hand with this kind of occupying story. It's not the last time we'll hear it. Snyder basically gives him a life and death kind of ultimatum. It's basically, you work with us or we'll take you, your wife, and your kids and send them all to the factory.
So in trying to kind of gain some sort of time frame, we're sort of watching and paying attention. So there's been a lot of rebranding like gone all around. Like Paul was saying, the cars are rebranded and there's buildings, there's the TV, the medicine has run out and everything. So we're trying to gain an idea of how long has this occupation happened. And so what do you think, Paul? Are we going for like at least a year or are we going?
That's what I was thinking.
Okay, I think like a year.
Yeah,
because
if you were thinking about a city the size of LA and how many possible diabetics they would have, and the fact that they still have in the fridge at the hospital some
kind of
vials.
Lot. Yeah.
At some point, that stuff would just reach zero.
Yeah.
You know?
No, for sure.
And so a year might even be generous. But
maybe.
Yeah.
I 6 months then? What do you think? Everybody's so like already into this life.
And that's
like,
why I think it's a year.
The codes and crap.
I think it would take some time for people to acclimate and just kind of. The people that don't want to be resistant but don't want to become stooges, just finding a way to acclimate and get along, I still think that might take as much as a year before you're as
I wonder if you
smoothly
have
accustomed to it as they seem to be.
But I wonder if you really have that luxury. I wonder if we're so out of touch of what it would be like to be occupied, if we would be shocked, if it would be literally a couple of weeks before you knew exactly you have to walk on the right side of the line you got to duck your head when you're over here. You can only talk to him. Like, I wonder how long it would really take. I'm sure there's historical documents or some sort of studies that could say if you put humans in this situation, it takes them X amount of time to come up with a secret language, a way to get around the rules, whatever. And I bet it's probably a shorter period of time than we think. It's interesting. I'm curious to find out when they start to expand here. Back at the Sullivan household, and the authorities roll up in this insane, like, screech kind of way, like wild, which you said reminded you of something, of some other way?
Well, it reminded me of the movie The Kingdom. The way that they drive in Saudi Arabia is just like, if they go too slow, then there's some chance that they might get caught by someone who's looking to, you know, interrupt them. So they have to go as fast as they can, stop for the shortest amount of time possible, and then peel out. And that's what it looked like to me.
That's how we've come to see that these, whatever the authorities are, how they seem to drive all around. Katie is in the living room. She starts yelling out for everyone to basically get their go bags and like they're going to take off. No, here's the funny thing. Amongst this yelling and sort of almost running in a circle that she's doing, in that amount of time, the authorities pull up, Will gets out, and he's like almost in the house, and they haven't done anything. Like, the people are
She's not running any drills, apparently.
The people are not down in the living room. They have no bags sitting there. Like, if this was their, like, escape plan, if this was a dry run, they all fail. Total failure on their parts. Will just comes bebopping in, and he clearly has decided that he is going to try to keep everything to a very mellow place, keep the anxiety as low as he can. So he just tells this little tale of doing his delivery, gotten a little fender bender. You know, he ended up being out after curfew, but they wouldn't let them call anyone. So he was super sorry, but, you know, just everyone should go to bed. It's all cool.
Everyone seems pretty willing to let this completely unconvincing story just go.
Well, they all definitely look at him and look at each other like, yeah, that's not what happened at all. But I guess we're at a time and place where you just can't do anything else other than just be like, okay, go to bed. Maybe it's not more comforting to know what really happened. I don't know.
Will goes and gets a shower.
Okay, so this next couple of scenes, Paul and I are willing to put down like $1,000 that they shot, reshot sometime past, and then they shuffled these scenes around in some way, because this part, as a married couple who have a teenage son, Bram, which means they've been together for at least, you know, 15 years or something, I do not believe that this is how this part would play out.
Will comes out of the shower, and Katie sees him just for about a second.
She's sitting on the end of the bed, and she's got her hands in that sort of like, you know, boy, we've really got to talk about this. Like, I can't believe what just happened. I can't believe you just took off looking for our son when, you know, you didn't even say anything. That is what the normal course of crap would have happened here. Now, instead, in a completely gigantic departure from reality, she just whips her shirt off and they decide to have sex. Now, here is the goofy part of this sex scene that I swear to God they just, again, plunked in there. Paul and I are convinced that USA came back and said, we want a sex scene in the pilot. Put one in there somewhere. And they were like, shoot, where are we going to put a sex scene? Like, okay, let's go back to that part where they would have been up there at night. Because let me just say, the sex scene was so stupid. It was like, I will say it more descriptively. It was like 3 or 4 humps and he's totally done. And he just like lays down and it's like over. And then we don't cut away or anything. We just proceed to start kind of talking a little bit. What? I know that Paul has given me that, you know, when a soldier comes home, they got to just have sex right away kind of talk. Whatever, okay? I got this message. However, because this has come up in other shows, but I don't even believe that this was like a, I love you and I'm so glad you're safe. Like, it didn't even come off like that, because it wasn't any type of making love. I'm so cherishing you right now. It wasn't like that at all. It was goofy.
I tried to sell Caroline this idea that Katie's just this woman driven by her passions. And Caroline said, No way, Jose.
I mean, I'm with you. Like, I get it. But I mean, I'm appealing to any woman who is listening to this right now. And especially, I don't even care. I'll say men to spouses, okay? You've been married for a while. Your husband or wife has just gone out and done something utterly stupid and dangerous, okay? Right? You maybe have a moment where you hug them like she did in the foyer where she's like, thank God you're alive. Thank God you're here. I can't believe that just happened. But the very next step is not to have sex. It's to say, what the hell were you thinking? Why did you do that? Do you know what could have happened? This is crazy. And that scene happens, but it later. So this whole part, I just felt like the editing dude just, maybe he even just like threw this crap in there for time. I don't know what.
Well, the trouble is, given the conversation that they were going to have, they weren't going to have sex at the end of that conversation.
No, they weren't. Oh, this is just a killer. So, okay, so we have him getting out of the shower. Inexplicably, they have sex. Then they just, the sex is stupid. Let me just say, the sex is stupid. I put lame. I said one-sided. And I was like, I just don't buy it that she would have been in the mind space in any way to have wanted to have sex with him. And I just don't even, like, I think he was even surprised that she threw her shirt off. So it was like, okay, what just happened there?
That may be true. He's like, well.
Yeah, no joke. Like, he's like, I thought we were going to talk, but all right.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yes.
So they, after the completely unfulfilling sex, they do not go to sleep. They are both awake.
And they don't cut away to commercial and they don't dissolve. They don't do anything. We just start having this other weirdness.
This other conversation where I couldn't decide if they were starting at the end of their little talk or somewhere in the middle. It didn't feel like the beginning because they resort to what I wrote down in my notes as just the kind of shit stuff that you say when you feel like you're having the same old argument over and over again, so you end up saying the same old stuff. The kind of business like, well, you have all the answers, and then you storm out or whatever. And that's what they pull on each other.
They do. And so they start doing this. So Will ends up getting up out of bed and stalking off and like leaving. All right, what? I mean, we were going back to this whole idea, like, okay, we know he's not actually going anywhere, right? Because, I mean, they have curfew, so he's not leaving or anything. But, like, they just had sex. Everyone, like, has barely been in bed, I swear to God, because it's only been the length of the shower and this super stupid two-second sex scene. I don't even know what's going on. So then he totally storms out. The next scene we have is them laying in bed together, totally cuddled up, with no explanation of what the hell happened in between. Again, editor. What are you doing?
And she's wearing the same PJs as 2 days ago. The blue tank top with the scrunchy shoulders.
Yeah, which she was not wearing when they had this argument and they were already in bed for the night and he left. So now she's back into blue scrunchy pajamas. We can't understand what's going on at all. The flow seemed super unnatural. All I can blame is that this had to be one of those things where they shot a pilot, they had it in the can, and then someone came back with studio notes and said, like, hey, you know what? You're going to need to add a sex scene. We want him to storm out. We want some more tension or something. I don't know what. And so they threw this all in and kind of shuffled around the scenes to try to make it seem like that could have happened. But it didn't make any sense at all. So strange. So then in the morning, they're in bed together. They are awoken to the smell of bacon downstairs, which is, I'm sure, a luxury.
Remember that when they went to bed, Madison and Hudson were in the house, which means that since it was curfew,
they had to sleep.
They didn't leave. But now when they get up, they first of all, they find Snyder, Proxy Snyder, and a couple of key goons such as Captain Garza or La Garza down in the kitchen where Snyder is making eggs and breakfast of a sort that seems pretty
very elaborate.
Normal. Right now, for, you know, maybe Mother's Day.
But, I was going to say, that was not,
but,
not a normal day around here.
But to them, looked like a complete extravagance, given that they were crying about single broken eggs, you know, a couple days
absolutely,
ago.
Absolutely, yeah. So we can't figure out where Madison and Hudson live and what's their scene.
Because they don't show up. The other kids do.
Yeah, and they're like, hey, what's going on? And then, of course, they're freaked out because there's, like, authority people, like, in their kitchen.
Because this guy's on TV in the propaganda videos.
Mm-hmm. So this is all freaky. Proxy Schneider gives the kids plates of food and they head off happily. Now we're going to have to get down a little bit more details here with old Will.
He points out that joining him would give them access to stuff like this all the time. And there would be other perks involved also. Part of the pillow talk last night before Will stormed out was him describing his predicament, that Snyder has him over a barrel. He wants him to join him. And Kate had reacted in very strong terms. She said, the resistance considers any collaboration and you die. When Snyder mentions that they would also, of course, have Homeland Security looking after them,
Katie snarks out, we'd have to have it because people will be trying to kill us. Schneider goes into a whole spiel about how, you know, this is all temporary and our hosts will leave after they satisfy their needs. Will gives them the, like, what are their needs? Which, sadly, as viewers, Schneider's not going to tell us. And, you know, he's like, oh, you know, we're all doing fine. It's all fine. And Will's like, you know, let me bring you out to the flats, which is apparently, I'm going to go with, the ghetto of some sort, and where it's going very poorly.
Not necessarily the ghetto. It just seemed like, remember, his house was up on the hill. You know?
Okay. So you're calling it the flats?
And the flat was, yeah.
It also kind of sounds like deserted, like flatland. I don't know. Seems like sad, anyway. Deserted. The proxy decides, okay, you know what? I'm going to move over to Katie. And so he goes over to Katie and is like, hey, listen, I really think that our hosts have been
undervaluing recreation.
Entertainment, right? Yes. Entertainment. And so you had a bar, the Yonk of Pataka, and we want to let you start the Yonk back up. So
he's provided a little carrot for her now.
Right. Now, okay, do you know what I find like kind of fascinating about this? I can't believe that they had him handcuffed at that cocktail party last night and they let him leave without signing in blood that he would absolutely join. Because it's like they gave him like 12 hours to, I don't know, dig a hole to China. Why, if they thought he was such a savvy guy who's going to be able to root out the resistance, did they give him all that time? Now, I'm sure they probably had people sitting outside his house, I guess.
I guess we'd have to assume that.
Yeah, but do you get what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
like,
for sure.
Why wouldn't you just lock that down? Like, you're in right now at this cocktail party.
Because
I'm not
going to
come
that,
and convince you later.
Because he pulls that at breakfast. He says,
yeah.
I need your answer right now. Yes,
yeah,
or no.
Yeah, no, totally. Why wouldn't he have done that the night before? That's why I think these scenes are cut out of, I'm telling you, they're cut out of sequence. I think that Schneider scene, I honestly think this stuff happened out of sequence. The editor like put this all differently because it doesn't make sense that they would have let him go and then the next morning be like, I told you, you have to tell me right now. Like,
super possible.
What are you talking
I agree.
About? That doesn't make any sense.
Some of the things have just kind of rough transition. Before he agrees, Will has one part of the bargain he wants to define. He says, if I do this, I want my son back. We were separated. Snyder doesn't exactly say yes or no. He just very strongly implies that he can do it. He says, you help me, I will help you. Okay, I guess that's not exactly a verbal contract of performance, but
I think it would be awfully hard to be like, okay, let's go with that. If they're acting like Will has some negotiating here, like the way that they're trying to persuade them and stuff, I don't get this at all because it seems like you have to do what you're told. They act like you have to do what you're told all the other parts, but now they're acting like Will and Katie somehow have reason to be persuaded and like, you know, let's wine and dine you into being a part of us. A little wacky. We go to at nighttime and Katie is drinking by the pool by herself, which I totally did not
know. I think Snyder would actually really prefer to have him on staff than have
like
to liquidate
willingly?
His family.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree. Totally agree. So I guess you're right. They can't really just kill them all. So I guess they do have some cachet.
He's got a problem that he believes Will can help him with, even though Will's not very enthusiastic about it.
Right. That makes sense. So, okay. So now we have like another scene that seems out of place because we go from breakfast all the way till nighttime with no conversation between Katie and Will that we're shown. None. Katie is drinking by the pool. Now, we've already seen their backyard with an orange tree and no pool. And now we're being shown like a almost like no landscaped yard with a pool that she's sitting beside. Like it's all like concrete backyard. Okay. And so she's sitting there drinking. He comes out and he's like, I gotta go to work. And she's like, okay, I just want to let you know I'm with you. So I'm sorry, he's decided to work for Schneider a-hole, and we get no conversation here about any of this. We just go from breakfast, them bitching, to her sitting by the pool drinking. Wacky. Yeah. That is wacky, because this is like what the whole series decision is really like comes from, is this fork where you had to decide which way are you going to go? Are you going to collaborate or are you going to go with the resistance? And they made that decision off screen. How weird is that? I think that's kind of crazy, right? I don't know why they shot it like that.
I don't know about you, but in the back of my mind, I'm kind of hoping that Will is not going to try very hard, you know?
No, I agree. I hope he's some sort of double agent or something like that, but I don't know. You get what I'm saying, right? Why would they have made, they have been advertising the show, like, which way are you going to go? And then you have your central family make the decision, and we don't get to be anywhere a part of that.
Right.
Weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
If it had been, maybe, hopefully they can build that into the suspense of...
What was their conversation?
Yeah, and well, and how are they going to work this? Because as we find out in the next scene, Katie goes to someplace she calls Grandma's.
It was funny. There's like an old grandma sitting on the porch, and they both do another one of those planned code talks, but it is so much more awkward because this old lady's like, hello, and then she's like, good morning, Grandma, I'm here for breakfast, and she's like, you're early, and she's like, I came hungry, and you're like, oh, okay, I totally get this is one of those party conversations, but that was weird. So then Grandma reaches up and rings the wind chimes, like, that was so funny.
She takes Katie through the house and to the backyard, where they open up a secret door in the back of the garage. And inside she finds the man that was helping, or that helped her earlier, that had been working on his house, and a few other individuals, an older guy sitting at a workbench and a pretty hardy looking woman also standing there.
So I have a question mark. So if you were having any kind of hideout and there was drones of any sort that were flying overhead, why would you make the entrance to the hideout like in the backyard where you had to walk outside to like get in? Why wouldn't you figure out some other hideout that doesn't expose you to the one thing they've shown you? Like, they've never shown us, oh, I don't know, surveillance cameras inside the homes or something.
Maybe they already had the secret door.
Maybe. Maybe this is like where they had like a clubhouse just generally.
Now, when I saw the guy sitting at the bench who appears to be the guy in charge, my first thought was, this is not Geronimo.
No, I don't think it is.
I'd be surprised to find out that this guy's Geronimo.
No, I don't think we're going to see Geronimo for some time.
It's up to Katie to kind of say why she called this meeting.
So Katie says, you've got someone on the inside. And they're all like, who? What's your, like, what? Like, and like, I think you said the brawny woman's all like, who? Like, smart mouth, what you got? She's like, me.
The occupation hired my husband to hunt us down. And that's how it ends.
So that's the giant reveal of like, okay, so Katie is 100% participating in the resistance to the level of going to the secret clubhouse and, you know, being participating at this level. I had a couple different questions. I did want to know, like, how long has she been in the resistance that she would know that the resistance was doing these bombings, and they all seem to having to do a lot with these deliveries. That's what they kept kind of saying. And the thing that bugged me a lot about that is that her husband's a delivery driver. Why wouldn't she have said to him, like, can you get like a different line of work or something? I'm scared that the resistance keeps blowing up things. If she freaking knew. Like, so that makes me wonder, like, how high or low is she to even have known that? And then, and then that makes me feel like, does she doesn't care if Will gets killed?
I got the impression, given the way that the guy at the workbench and the other people kind of regarded her when she came in, she may have never been in that room before. Because I have the idea...
They didn't give her, like, the Heil Hitler move. They didn't. They were like, what are you doing here?
So I got the idea that she was a very junior member of their little club there.
I'm still really trying to think this through. Because what is old Katie's motivation? She says, I'm on your side. I'm with you to Will. And watches him go walk off to go do scary crap that he doesn't want to do. I can't understand like how that would benefit her whole family here. Like she's real insistent that, you know, by you working and collaborating, you're going to like tear this family apart and these children are going to be taken. Da, da, da. And then like, meanwhile, she like goes to basically tear this family apart in a totally different way. Is she just that nasty and double-faced or what? Two-faced?
It does put her in a position that would make a lot of pretty decent TV. You know, that she's now put in a position where she doesn't want Will to catch anybody in her resistance.
Right.
But then she doesn't want Will to perform so badly that
they basically
decide
or
to,
do they, or does she only because, wait, is the only reason why she doesn't want Will to perform so badly that he gets hurt or killed or whatever because she's looking out for her own skin and her kids? Or do you think it's also because he's like, he is the info? So
well,
do you think it's...
when we talked about this, I always read it as she was legitimately worried about Will, the way she searched for him so hard. But you made me look at it a different way, that she has a very high self-interest in not having anyone look too hard at her or anything like that. So if Will gets caught doing something weird and they start looking at the family, then the whole family's at stake and maybe the resistance is at stake. So her motivations could be highly mixed.
Right. And I think, you know, we talked a lot about the concept of like double agents and the idea that I don't know that we've seen double agents with kids, like in a family situation like this. Like,
no.
So like we talked about like Mr. and Mrs. Smith and the concept of having like a married couple. And that was actually kind of an intriguing new concept. And you were telling me about like the Americans have kind of an interesting dynamic.
Well, we haven't
in that
watched,
same way.
I've only watched the pilot, but I got a good idea of what that's going to look like. We need to watch a little bit more of that, but yeah, the idea of having your...
like a married couple with kids.
Yeah, kids at stake in this thing.
Who are then, and who are sort of this running these two different lives or whatever. I don't know what to think about this. I think it makes me feel like this is a little bit rough. Inevitably, with the age of Bram, there is no way that one or the other parent isn't going to have to use him. I, without a doubt, like either Katie is going to have to be like, I need you to go run this package to grandma, and whether he knows what he's really doing and that he's a part of the resistance or not, or Proxy Schneider is going to be like, hey, you know what? Maybe your great skills are going to rub off on your kid. Why don't you two need to be doing something? I kind of feel like the age of Bram is very close to young soldiery kind of age.
I think initially Bram is going to find his own problems because the way
really?
the way that she was like, he's a good kid, seemed to be tail end of an old conversation again, where maybe this isn't the first time he's broken somebody's nose with his backpack. You know, maybe, you know, he means well, but he's not going to run from a fight either.
Well, and the way that he was doing like the kind of behind the scenes bartering, which I don't know if that's acceptable to be doing that bartering or not. It seems like,
well, they're trading oranges and tuna, so I don't...
tortillas, but it didn't seem like there was like that level of micromanaging in the citizens' world. Like no one was saying you can only have two oranges at your house. Like nothing seemed that. Did it seem that stringent?
No, I don't think so.
So then what he was doing wouldn't be classified as resistance or anything like that. It was just, I don't know, just quality of life kind of stuff.
Yeah. I looked up, like I said, that French stuff and they were issued like food tickets and they could use French money to buy things, but they had come up with an exchange rate that was impossible. It was like 20 French dollars, whatever those are, to one Reichmark, which was the German, you know, dollar. And so that made it so that you had to way overpay for anything. And it didn't mention anything about a bartering being illegal. Since it seems so patterned after that, I would just kind of keep looking back.
And I don't
that.
Think you can stop people. Like I said, like I think that that's just like such a natural go-to. I mean, little kids bartering at lunch, like you said, like the snack packs and stuff, like that's just like, that's such a primal, I'll trade you this, you trade me that. Like that's so natural that I don't think you can completely stop that kind of stuff. All I wonder about it is, does that give us an indicator, since they just stuck that bleacher scene? Is that an indicator that Bram is what? Like he is kind of actively participating in this kind of like trying to have a quality of life community within the rules? Or is he a little bit about pushing the rules, like we're going to go to grandma's house and we're going to be getting the insulin from the dog's pancreas?
Well, if we can read anything into that shout out to the godfather, he would have been in the position of Don Vito, which
means he's going to be...
He's okay with breaking a few laws.
Okay, so then does that lead you to believe, though, if you think that Bram is a natural someone to pull in, is Katie going to pull him in or is Will going to pull him in? And will Bram have to sell out one or the other?
That's very interesting stuff. I think Katie would be more interested in protecting him, but...
I think she's the first one to freaking sell him out. Because I think she's got this weird, how can I say, like the way that she's willing to kind of let Will, he's going to take some lumps because of things she does, like no doubt, right? I mean, because she's going to have to tell the resistance, like, you know what? I think he's been hanging around over here. And I mean, by saying that stuff, he is going to get some bad stuff's going to happen to him. So to me, I just say she's the one that's going to have that kind of thinking of like, oh, how do I want to say it? Like that longer term, I'm fighting for a way of life, kind of hippy dippy, like, and where you want to shake that person and say, but do you see your own child is going to die or something? You know, those people who kind of have causes and they kind of get so wrapped up in their cause that there's sort of this like, do you even notice that your own kid needs a bath or whatever, where they sort of a little start selling out everyone and everything because of their cause. Their cause is so much more important. And like, I don't see Will, like Will's not in for the cause. Like he's just going to go to work and get it done because he feels like he has to. But Katie, this is all about like her heart. Like you said, this passion business. And I kind of think that's going to get in the way of her being a mother.
Makes it important what happened between when Snyder left and when Will left for work.
Very much. That was a whole
day. They might have come
up
with their whole scheme. Maybe he knows, but I doubt it.
But who knows, right? And so, I mean, they very much could have purposely, you know, left out an entire day for us so that maybe we're going to get bits and pieces throughout the next couple episodes or even across the season of what was talked about that day or decided. I don't know. Well, we super look forward to Colony Episode 2 coming out.
Yeah, this was a pretty strong start. I would have preferred not getting into the action just in the first 5 minutes, but
with the explosion,
what
and
they
stuff.
Did. So here we are, and I think it's a good start.
I'm cool with Will. I'm cool with this character and stuff. Katie, like I already kind of hate her, so I'm already feeling like I'm kind of supposed to have strong feelings for everybody.
Is
so
that just Lori feelings?
Sort of, but I don't go in for this, you know. Don't like all the hiding from your husband and the, you know, like to me, either you are, you know, you're in it as a family or like, you know, or everybody's dying because there's no way around it, you know? And I think that's what the tension is with this is basically like, how long can this family survive? Because you can't survive if one's sneaking around on the other, you know? I think it's yucky to think that Will is going to go out at night to try to protect his family and kind of look at Katie thinking like, you stay here and protect the kids. And meanwhile, she's going to be like Morse coding, like Will's going to, you know, 51st and, you know, whatever. And it's like, oh,
well, the trick
hurts my belly.
The trick to resistance is, and I don't know about all instances, but they seem to be wanting to pattern after the occupation of France. All the resistance could do was resist.
Right, like interrupt, right?
Yeah.
That's all you can do is interrupt.
They needed the invasion of Normandy to actually regain the country.
Right.
They needed an outside overwhelming force to coordinate with and then retake the country.
So interesting. So I don't know what the dynamic for that could be, especially if we think our hosts are alien.
Yeah.
And we have to have some good aliens to come in.
And they actually come in and put down like these football stadium sized walls all around.
Fast enough that families got separated.
Yes. So, resisting seems like a tough way to go.
I'm going to have to think hard about this collaborate or resistance. And it does seem like you only get to be in that, I'm not sure, zone, purgatory land for a short period of time.
Well, I looked it up. And the French had two categories. They had what they considered to be collaborators and collaborationists. And collaborators were the ones like Snyder that actively participated in colluding with the Nazis and kept their fellow Frenchmen down. And collaborationists, they kind of went along with the program, but they didn't share the same ideals, but they still found a way to kind of profit from what was going on. Maybe they weren't living in the green, but maybe they were bartering for the best oranges anyone's ever seen. I don't know. At the end of the war, the resistance went around before anybody could stop them, just killed a lot of the collaborators before anyone could do anything. That's what they did. The collaborationists, they weren't as sore with, but collaborators, they...
So the Snyders, the proxy Snyders, killed them
all.
The
funny thing was, at the end of that, the puppet government that was working with the Nazis, they tried to round up collaborators to be like, see, we're part of the solution. And when the resistance got to them, they wound up hanging a bunch of them. So that if that's how the pattern's going to go, I bet they diverge at some point. The little homages, like the cafe abduction, are nice and all, but... you don't want them to follow something so closely like that. Did you be able to predict how it's going to go?
It'll be super interesting to see how they choose to go, though, because I think that there's been a lot of conversation about, do you keep calm and carry on, or do you fight back? You know, and is it like if you interrupt your normal everyday life, then the terrorists win? Wait, if I just keep calm and keep to my everyday life, then I just have to put up with terrorism, like, in my periphery, but I'm not supposed to look at it, because if I look at it, then that like disturbs my life, and then they win, and it's like, okay, wait, what? Like, what are we supposed to be doing? Are we, at some point, do you fight back? Like, that's the kind of place where I actually think like kind of America's at, where we're like, what the hell? Like, what are we supposed to be doing? Everybody keeps saying just like, don't let the terrorists win, but if we just keep doing what we're doing, people are getting blown up, stuff's happening, you know? So it'll be interesting. I feel like that this is coming at an interesting time. Makes me wonder if the pilot was sitting on the shelf for any period of time.
I don't know.
Or the idea.
There were preview images of it a long time ago. I think they were at Comic-Con, and I thought it was going to be a fall show. So it was weird that it came to the spring, but you know, maybe it was always meant to be a spring show. I don't know.
Intrigue. So, well, I look forward to episode 2. So thanks for listening, you guys.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.